Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Mishkin Law in Chicago, joined by my co-host, Rob Hunt, back from his travels to Colorado and all the skiing he got to do out there. And our producer, Dan Humiston, as always, with us today. Great show for you guys today. A lot of really interesting things to discuss. Yes, playing in the sand gets discussed. There's some big news in the cannabis industry that we'll get to that suggests that we're seeing interesting directions for where cannabis companies want to go right now. And we get to throw a little fatherly pride on our producer towards the end. But we're looking forward to all of it. Rob, how you doing? And welcome back.
Great to be back. I got to say, I'm pretty excited because this officially marks the second year I've been part of this team. So second calendar year. It feels like it's been almost a full year since I joined as a co-host. So really, really fun. I'm pleased to be back. And I also want to say that no disrespect to Colorado, but I was actually skiing in Utah. And between the two, you know, I will take a pot shot at Colorado and just let everyone know just how much better the skiing is in Utah than it is in you know, my former home state of Colorado. But having lived in both states for years, there's really no comparison between the two. Utah just gets so much more snow and the terrain's just so much more fun.
Okay. Good to know and something to keep in mind. And I'm sure the folks in Colorado have something to say about that. We're always happy to listen to them on that.
Don't at me.
Right, exactly. So we're nothing on this show if not full of ironies. We have a great show to talk about today, and it's a show that we've mentioned from time to time because it is, in fact, the very first show that our farmer co-host, Jim Marty, now in retirement, ever saw from Springfield, Massachusetts back in January 15th, 1979. And without any further ado, Dan Humiston, please let's spin a little music and listen to what we got coming out of that show right away. That's a great song as always, and that's a great version of it, Rob. I know this is a show that holds some meaning for you. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I led with that one because I think it's a great double entendre, because if you listen to the opening line of that song, it's, you know, I don't trust nothing, but I know it'll come out right. And I was really hoping that would be the case with Playing in the Sand, not Playing in the Band, but I think that we were all hoping, you know, that that Omicron would not end up doing the same thing to the Dead that it did to Fish for New Year's and tons of other bands. And unfortunately, it looks like we all trusted to nothing and it came out wrong on this case. And, you know, first it looked like we were just losing, you know, potentially, you know, John Mayer, but we were going to get Tom Hamilton in replace. And I was delighted when I heard that. And I'll take Tom Hamilton anytime playing anything Grateful Dead related. And so I was actually like, okay, this is going to be fantastic. But then when you actually had the next band member, you know, reveal COVID positive as well, really too bad. And I know tons of people, we both know tons of people, Larry, that are really looking forward to Playing in the Sand this year. And this time it just didn't appear to happen.
No, and that includes Jim Marty, who was going to be there. And in fact, we had high hopes that we'd be hearing from him today from Mexico with an update on the first weekend of Playing in the Sand. I had a chance to talk to Jim very briefly, and based on where the numbers were going and what was happening, he and his wife opted to take advantage of the refund offer and did not travel down. But one of his friends did, in fact, was planning on going both weekends and traveled down, only to find, of course, that the shows were canceled. Now, canceling shows for COVID is nothing new. It's happened quite a lot over the last 2 years, and for better or for worse, rock fans, you know, no matter what your band of choice is, are getting used to it. And, you know, it almost got to the point where, you know, as we were leading up to New Year's, every day, you know, I had my phone, whatever it was set to, jamband.com. There was always, it was buzzing with yet another show that was being canceled, show after show around the country. Fish, of course, the biggest blow of all, I suppose, for those who are big Fish fans and big Jam Band fans and really like what Fish does on New Year's Eve. But, you know, I think that there's some tough stuff that has to be said about the Grateful Dead or Dead & Co. under these circumstances. And it's something that really kind of bothered me. This was not handled well. This was not only not handled well, but I think it really kind of highlighted a side of Dead & Co. that many of us have just kind of accepted with a grain of salt because we're excited to go out there and see these guys. But, you know, these guys in their current version have really seemed to become a more, let's just say, you know, profit-based operation. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, every group that goes out there and plays, they're, you know, they're doing it for a living and to keep themselves and their families and their groups and their support group and staff and all of that. That's a lot of people. It's a lot of money. And I don't take any of that lightly. But, you know, with the Dead, there was always this sense that, you know, that the fans and the family came first. And, you know, the profit, if there was a profit, came later. And, you know, by operating in that way, you know, the Dead did very well for themselves. And, you know, I'm not here to say what anybody has a right to or not to go do. But with shows being canceled everywhere, the idea that they were going to really bring this thing off in Mexico with all the international travel that was involved and people coming from everywhere, and, you know, the best advice they could give you was stay on the hotel grounds and don't go into any of the local locations, it just was an untenable situation for too many people who couldn't afford to get over there, then test positive and have to quarantine in Mexico waiting to get back into the United States. And it seems to me that the call should have been made a lot sooner and, you know, long before people were even close to getting on airplanes and flying down there, far enough in advance that people could get refunds and could go and, you know, make their own plans in terms of what they wanted to do instead. You know, and in that respect, I have to really applaud Phish, both in terms of their timing and their immediate follow-up saying, not a problem, we're going to give you guys live music on New Year's Eve. And we're going to find a way to do it. And it's not going to be ideal, but it's going to be better than nothing. And this is our way of saying thank you to the fans. And, you know, the Dead's way of saying thank you to the fans was some crazy quote by Mickey about how, well, we tried to ride the virus and, you know, we got burned doing it or something. And it was like, really? You know, it kind of struck me the wrong way that, you know, the idea of, well, if we cancel, we're all out a lot of money. It's going to cost a lot. And I wasn't very happy about that. And, you know, maybe I'm being a little too picky about it, but I expect more from the Dead.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's always the band that makes that decision. I think oftentimes it's the promoter. So it all depends on, you know, who else they're answering to. Because, you know, if you say who's going to pull the plug, I think most of the time the band's like, yeah, we'll play as long as the promoter tells us that this thing's still on. In this case, you know, I'd be looking more to point my finger at CID Entertainment and whether or not Burko made the right decision, you know, going forward on this thing. So, you know, again, there might have been, we don't know what those contracts look like. We don't know whether or not coronavirus was considered to be a force majeure event or whether or not, you know, there was other things. I don't know what the deposit situation was with the hotel or the resort. You know, there could be a lot of other things in play there where someone could be saying, you know, thinking about from the standpoint of, hey, we stand to lose a ton of money that we can't get back if this thing cancels. So unless we absolutely have to, you know, let's keep this thing on. So the band, I think, has some influence in those situations. But yeah, I think the promoter has a bigger influence.
You know, and you may very well be right. You know, and look, far be it from me to sit here in, you know, nice Chicago, Illinois, and try and judge what somebody else was doing. But, you know, I mean, knowing people who were going down there and just, you know, thinking to myself, man, if I had tickets for this thing at this point, I would be really messed up trying to figure out what to do and where to go. And, you know, yeah, sometimes it's kind of nice to see the band members stand up and say, you know what, under the circumstances, this just isn't right. Again, I get there's a lot of money involved. I understand all of that. It's, you know, but I always like to look at the Grateful Dead as and the whole Dead family as being this entity that certainly was part of the rock scene and, you know, certainly benefited from it, and well, they should, but also always kind of seem to march to their own tune and, you know, put different values ahead of the values of the big boys in the rock and roll suites. The other issue that I thought was really interesting with all of it was that John Mayer being diagnosed positive was not in and of itself enough to cancel the event. Now, I don't disagree with you about Tom Hamilton. And for God's sakes, you know, there's all sorts of guys who, you know, they could bring in, you know, Warren Haynes. We could go on and on with the names of guys who could step in at the last minute and play for John Mayer in that situation and, you know, do a really good job. But it just made me think, you know, in 1986, when Jerry drops with a diabetic coma, they weren't talking about finding a replacement for Jerry to keep playing. Right.
Carlos wasn't, you know, jumping in to sit in with them.
Right. Yeah. But the band stopped, you know, and some of us who had second row center seats for the Fox Theater in St. Louis, you know, were disappointed, but understood the man's dying, that this is what it has to be. But, you know, I don't think that at the time there was ever a thought that, well, we could just bring in somebody else to fill in for him and it'll all be good. Again, you know, Dead & Co. is great. It's nice to have them out there. They provide a fun environment for deadheads to come out and be part of the old scene. And, you know, every now and then they hit a tune that's really a lot of fun. Generally speaking, I don't typically enjoy their versions of the Dead songs, but I like the concerts enough that I'm happy to go see them and everything like that. But they've spent a lot of time talking about, you know, how John Mayer hasn't just, you know, joined the band, but he has become the band, and that, you know, the intricate onstage conversation that he's developed with Jeff Comenti and with, you know, with all the other guys and with Bobby, and how he's really kind of taken charge and he's, you know, really stepped out, and he's sick, no problem, we got a replacement for him, boom. And I thought, wait a second, you know. And then, I you know, again, you can tell me if you think I'm too sensitive, but on the heels of that, all of a sudden, Bobby's saying, we know it's bad, but don't worry, we're going to promise you some rare gems from the vault, or whatever his line was suggesting, you know, that they were going to pull out some really old tunes. And I thought, I don't know, you know, it just, a lot of it rubbing me the wrong way, and just not the way I would like to see, you know, the Dead handling a situation like that. I'm sure there's a lot of Deadheads out there who are very frustrated. I'm sure there's a lot of Deadheads out there who say, hey, we get it, and if they're doing it again next year, we're going right back, and God bless them, you know? It's a fun place and a fun scene, and I always see fun people when I'm there, and as long as they're going to go around and do shows, I'll certainly see them in my backyard.
Yeah, look, I don't think you're being too sensitive on that one, Larry. I mean, it's very, very appropriate to bring that up when you think that, you know, we have been sold that, you know, John Mayer is an irreplaceable guy. And suddenly when first, you know, opportunity, you know, look, I mean, there certainly could be a case made by the band saying, hey, well, we've all played with Tom Hamilton also. And Tom plays with Billy, and Tom plays with, you know, the Garcia band to play. And he's, you know, certainly filled the role to play with Joe Russo's Almost Dead. There isn't a single, you know, thing in there. But, I mean, look, you could be a great doubles tennis player playing really well with one partner, and all of a sudden you're paired up with someone else, and your game might be terrible because you don't know how to move around the court the same way. And I look at musicians in sort of the same respect, that Tom Hamilton might be absolutely amazing with Joe Russo, but you throw him in there with the rest of the Grateful Dead members, and he still might be good, but it's certainly not going to be what it is when you've played, you know, 400 or 500 gigs with those guys the way that that Mayer has at this point. So, you know, it's actually a really, really strong point that you're not getting kind of what you were sold. And, you know, someone called me up and said, okay, hey, Jimmy Herring can't play with Panic this weekend, and instead you're going to get, you know, name the person. I would be a little distressed, even though, you know, Jimmy was the replacement for, you know, years of having Mikey Houser there. So it's, you know, when you replace someone, you make a decision to replace someone with another band member, and then that becomes the new band member. You don't just throw in, you know, backups all the time. You know, it's not like in a sports team where you're running plays with the backup guys all the time and you're still having that sort of same rapport. Like, this is like you're throwing in someone cold.
Well, that's true. And it's more than true. You know, I'm just thinking, you know, I've told the story at least once, and my kids would probably say 1,000 times, of being at Folsom Field a couple of years ago and the kids behind me getting all excited because they were going into Althea, and they love the way John Mayer plays Althea. You know, to the point where they wanted to suggest that maybe he plays it better than Garcia. And I'm like, I'm thinking of those guys going to playing in the sand. Man, for them, John Mayer is the thing. And they get there, and he ain't there.
Well, the only thing I can think, though, and from my side, because you know I'm not a John Mayer fan, and I am definitely a Tom Hamilton fan, is I look at it sort of the same way that I wasn't a huge Drew Bledsoe fan. So when Tom Brady got thrown in, you know, kind of the end of that year, and all of a sudden came up and performed, and Bledsoe was no longer the guy, part of me was very, very satisfied that they had someone else to replace, you know. And same thing, like, you know, name any sports person that's the starting string guy that you're not all that pleased to see as a starting string guy, and you're almost cheering for the backup, you know. So like, there's some, you know, part of me that hopes Tom Hamilton goes down there, everyone goes, wow, he's so much better than Mayer. And the next iteration is, you know, that Mayer is out and Hamilton's in.
Right. And this whole idea about promising special songs, you know, that's so undead-like, you know, to say, oh, we're gonna really pull out a few, you better be down here. And if you're gonna pull out a few special songs, aren't they songs that supposedly you've been rehearsing with John Mayer? You know, they've always, you know, marched to their own beat, and as a Deadhead, you know, you march with them or you march off to the side. But maybe it explains a little bit more, you know, why Phil is off doing his own thing. I don't know. When I went and saw Phil and Friends with the Quintet, it was simple, it was easy. We went in, I got the Grateful Dead high that I was looking for 3 nights in a row, walked out of there, and and it was all good. At the end of the day, I think it's just a shame because we do know a lot of people who are really, really excited about getting down there, who really enjoy the scene, who really enjoy everything that you know, that Dead & Co. brings to this situation. But the other thing that it shined a light on, I just didn't realize how many bands are doing it now. And they were talking about, apparently, Wilco has a show going on down there, and Phish always does a show in Mexico. I haven't heard a whole lot about Phish's Mexico show this year.
Yeah, it, I mean, look, this, the resort they do it at, the Riviera Maya Resort, I think it was the guys from Cloud Nine that were doing it first, and the same people put on Jam Cruise. And then, you know, obviously Phish did it, and then a bunch of other bands have done it, but there's definitely a trend of using, you know, sort of the Riviera Maya as a destination getaway. And it's... First of all, it's a great venue. Second of all, it's you know, a great setting. Third of all, plenty of people want to go to Mexico anyway on vacation. So, you know, why not do it that way? It's kind of the same idea as Jam Cruise. Like, hey, without taking a cruise, wouldn't it be more fun to do with all of our buddies and, you know, a bunch of live music? So it makes sense. You know, I can understand. I mean, Cancun's a relatively decent-sized airport, and it's only about a half-hour drive from there. So why not? Outside of the fact that, you know, you have to still be careful, A, because it's Mexico, and, you know, the cartels are still relatively rampant, and, you know, That's one concern. But then when you've got a pandemic where, you know, as you said, the important thing isn't necessarily not being able to get there. It's not being able to get home. So I certainly wouldn't want to be stuck in, you know, in a Mexican hospital for quite a while, or just being told, you know, you have to wait it out for another 10 days until you, you know, test negative twice. Look, everything in my life I have to reassess right now as a result of kind of the situation we're all faced with. And, you know, I've made the decision not to go to live music but for one or two times, and that was when, you know, numbers were substantiating that was a prudent decision. So I don't know if we're there. But look, let's talk about more positive Grateful Dead things. I mean, look, we're 57 years into the career of these guys. It's funny to me because I always think of the late 70s as being kind of halfway through the Grateful Dead era, but it really isn't. You know, it's basically like very, very early in the era if you include everything that's happened subsequent to 1995, which is now the majority of their careers, or close to majority of their careers, you know, like 27 years post-Jerry. But yeah, we did use that 1/15/79 as our intro and kind of the show that we're going to be talking about today. And one of the things I'll say about it, and we've touched on this before because it was Jim's first show, that this really represented the real transition of, you know, the Godshaw years into the Midland years. But 1/15/79 kind of is like representing, you know, the end of an era, but it's also one of the strongest shows, you know, I can think of. And, you know, you and I have talked about, there's certain things that Garcia was doing during that period, which is during his transition jams, was doing these really, really funky transitions from one song into another, really just kind of walking the board up and just playing scales as he was doing it. And I don't think there's a better representation out there than there is in what we're going to play next, is the transition from I Need a Miracle into Shakedown, which, you know, we can talk about on the other side, but, you know, I'll go on the record right now and say that for the last 20 years, there's nothing I'd rather hear coming out of the Grateful Dead than this transition, because it's just so unbelievably powerful dropping into the Shakedown. And it's one that, like, I can think of where I was when I first heard it. I was driving through the tunnel going back from Nassau Coliseum into New York City after a Nassau show in 1990. And a buddy of mine that had this guy named George Canalia had an amazingly fun Volkswagen Jetta with a sick sound system. And he cranked this thing up, and it absolutely blew my mind, and it's blown my mind ever since then. You know, we're going on, you know, how many years since 1990? And this one still remains. I still can't find anything that I like better in terms of a transition from song A to song B than what we're about to listen to. So Dan, let's fire that one up.
Just to close the door on the last subject, this is why I want to see the Grateful Dead all the time. And, you know, I appreciate what those guys are doing, but nobody's playing transitions from Miracle into Shakedown like that. And nobody can play transitions from Miracle into Shakedown like that.
John Mayer can't do that.
Nobody can do that. Nobody can do that. And, you know, the beauty of it is you could be anywhere, anytime, under any circumstance. And if somebody clicked that on, A, you would know it's the Grateful Dead right away. And B, what I love about it is it's that distinctive, you know, blah sound he makes with the guitar.
Yeah, it's the envelope fader.
That, you know, when he, as they're going into Shakedown. So you say to yourself, Shakedown. I don't quite hear it all yet, but I know that that's telling me Shakedown. And then as he builds up to this crescendo, they come crashing into Shakedown. And that's, yeah, I mean, that's, look, if it's a choice between that or seeing, you know, fill in the name of any band in the world, you know, play a really, really hot tune and then stop. Thanks, audience. We really love playing that song for you guys. You guys are great. You know, we're going to let, you know, Keith catch his breath over here. And then we've got another song. This is why we see the Grateful Dead, because it's not that. It's an entire journey. The second set, I always just kind of thought of it as a song. I didn't think of the second set so much as song stop. You know, on some nights, literally, right, they'd go straight from a Scarlet Fire jam all the way into Drums in Space, and then they could just as easily come out of Drums in Space and end the night. Maybe they'd get into a Round and Round stop and then do Sugar Magnolia or something. It was this beauty of getting you caught up in the moment of one song and then hitching onto that and carrying you over right into the next song. So you feel exhausted and exhilarated at the same time. Your body's like, oh, wait, this song is over, but here we go on the next one. It's amazing.
Yeah, look, and when I think about the whole transition, you know, obviously we only play a short bit on this, you know, for the audience. But you know, I encourage anyone to go back there, because the actual, you know, sort of slowdown or meltdown coming out of the I Need a Miracle is a really, really slow, mellow fade out before you start getting that buildup back in, which is what makes it even that much more exciting. Is you're kind of losing interest in the miracle when all of a sudden you hear the switch to the envelope pedal and you start hearing the wah-wah, you know, coming out that you get in an estimated or you get in a shakedown. And then just watching it build from there, where it just comes out of nowhere until it just explodes into the opening notes of Shakedown. Very, very few times do you get something that's that powerful coming in. You obviously, like, you know, you always wait for it, you know, transitioning from Slipknot into Franklin's, where you're waiting for the opening notes of the Franklin's. And there's other times where, you know, you're waiting for the opening notes of the Fire, where you're waiting for the first, you know. But in the Shakedown, normally Shakedown is starting off, you know, on its own. It's it opening a set, right? But to actually get something to sort of like walk it back down and then build it back up and then just explode into an already like full tilt Shakedown, that's why, like, on this specific one, I absolutely love it.
No, it's awesome. And I know you've mentioned it before and I've listened to it before, but again, you know, every time you hear it, it just gets you right up on your feet. And I'm like, not okay, Dan, no need to cut the Shakedown. We can just jam that all the way through and edit it out later. Because it is that good, and it's wonderful to listen to. And I think it really does define that era of the Grateful Dead. I Need a Miracle, Shakedown Street were very, you know, prominent, you know, disco dead era type tunes. In fact, I still have a distinct memory of seeing the Grateful Dead play I Need a Miracle on Saturday Night Live one night. You know, they were out there jamming on that and thinking, okay, whatever. You know, I was still a little too young to hop on the bus, but at least was getting curious enough to start thinking about it. And, you know, this is that period of time. In fact, you know, right over New Year's, our New Year's show, we talked about the Farewell to Winterland and how that show is many in many respects kind of like almost a transition from one era into the other. But this... Well, and we just, to be fair, we talked about how it was, you know, that they brought in a whole bunch of other stuff. There was a first Dark Star in forever and other stuff like that, and carried it over into the show we talked about last week from Nassau was that also 79? I don't even remember what show we were. Yeah, it was 79, and it was the one where they played the second Dark Star after it was on January 10th, so they had just played, they'd just broken out Dark Star for the first time in 4 years at Farewell to Winterland. And then not only that, but they also played St. Stephen that night. It was the last time they played St. Stephen for 4 years till they broke it out in the Garden in 83. So, you know, the late 70s, or, you know, as they spilled over into the 80s, was definitely this transition. But even here, it's almost more pronounced, because this is really creeping up. This is one of the last, you know, shows for Keith. We know that Brent joins the band in April of this year, in April of 79, on a show down in San Jose. So whether Jerry and the boys knew that this was coming, you know, whether they sensed it, whether it was something. But, you know, they go back and they play some of these tunes, and, you know, just a great miracle and a shakedown, I think, gives, you know, Grateful Dead fans a lot of hope that no matter where we wind up, guys, we got great stuff, you know, from this era now that is going to carry us forward till we figure out, you know, what else to do. And, you know, what a great time to be seeing the Grateful Dead. And, you know, even though I started seeing them in 82 and was very happy about that, I have always felt like I was just a few years too late, you know. And if you could have caught them in 78, 79 and just caught the tail end of that whole era and use that as a slingshot into the Brent era, that would have been wonderful. But, you know, I'm happy with what I got, and I'm happy to go back and listen to this.
Yeah, I love 1979. I think 79 has, everything's a little bit faster, really, really fun. Love the song selection. I've always been a huge 79 fan. I've always loved the Cape Cod Coliseum shows. Always loved Springfield. I think that the whole Northeastern run is just fantastic.
It is. It was a great time for the band, and a year I think that's often overlooked. And you know, 1979 and 1980, I think, often tend to get kind of pushed aside as a couple of down years when, you know, the band really kind of dropped about as low as it would ever get again in terms of followers and, you know, playing without necessarily selling out their, you know, the smaller venues, the hockey arenas. They were still selling out, I guess, the theaters and stuff. But, you know, they just kept, you know, right on pushing it. And, you know, by the time I started seeing them in the early 80s, they sure sounded like they were at full strength to me. And, you know, and just rolled forward with a lot of authority. But, you know, those are very transformative years, I suppose, you know, not to dwell too much, but, you know, to definitely take note of it. That's also right around the time that Jerry, you know, began his major switch from the psychedelic Jerry to the, you know, powder Jerry, whatever the powder was at the moment, but usually not the best thing in the world, and ultimately took him to a road that we all know how it ended. Not here to judge, not here to do anything. Just note that that was the time period where this was all going down. And, you know, on a number of those nights, he came out just shining. And, you know, if that was the powder of the day speaking to him, God bless. If that was just him being Jerry, even better. But it leaves us with such a deep, rich catalog of music from that period of time that, you know, we could just as easily focus on the late 78, all of 79, early 1980 era of the Grateful Dead, you know, and have a lifetime's worth of stuff to talk about.
Yeah, agree. Absolutely agree. Well, should we shift gears and talk about some Canvas World news these days?
Yeah, absolutely. Lead us off, because it looks like news in Canada is not quite as good as everybody would like it to be.
I think anyone that's been paying attention for a while would say that Canada's been a market in distress for quite a while, and certainly hasn't lived up to the expectations that I think the initial investors had. I think most industry professionals would tell you that there's no possible way Canada could ever live up to those expectations, as we've discussed previously. It's just not a big enough market. You know, it's a market smaller than California, yet it's the market cap of its, you know, top 10 businesses is significantly larger even now than the market caps of, you know, their American counterparts. You know, if you ultimately don't have a large TAM, a total addressable market, it's very, very difficult to realize the kind of value that you were promising to deliver. So, you know, for a while, the Canadian companies were saying, oh, yeah, we're going to migrate into the U.S. or we're going to open up shop in the LATAM market or the European market. And none of those things really happened. But for the first time, you're watching analysts, you know, admit that they are wrong and start to slash a lot of the revenue targets, the revenue estimates that are coming out of these companies, you know, which, again, doesn't surprise me at all. I'm just wondering what took people like Vivian Azar at Cowen so long to come to a conclusion that all of us were telling her 5 years ago was the truth. And just, you know, it always makes me wonder, and I don't know how much you interact with the analysts on Wall Street, Larry, but, you know, for a while, I was speaking to a lot of these guys, you know, relatively frequently, and they're backing into numbers where I'm like, you guys are absolutely nuts. Like, how are you giving someone credit for a value that's, you know, 6 times EBITDA 5 years downstream? Like, not this year's EBITDA, but, you know, 5 years from now. And then you're saying, we'll throw a multiple on that. It's like, why not just pick a number out of the sky and figure out how you're going to back into it? But there was no standard methodology or no standard metric. And I've watched, you know, like my buddy Jason Spadafora, who is, you know, better known as the Wolf of Wall Street. You know, he's been roasting those guys for years and very accurately, you know, saying this is nuts. And, you know, doesn't mean you shouldn't be investing in these things if you want to look at, you know, making some short-term dollars on flipping on news. But as a long-term hold strategy, a lot of these Canadian companies, like, there was no possible way they could sustain the value that they were putting up, whether it was, you know, Canopy, or whether it was Tilray, or whether it was Aurora, or whether it was Kronos. All of them were just ludicrous valuations.
Well, you know, let me ask you this. Do you attribute it to the fact that, I mean, we're basically talking about a market that's a brand new market that has no historical history or, you know, background or any kind of evidence? You know, I mean, the little that I know about analysts is, you know, there's a lot of, you're going to go out and, you know, give you an estimate on this year's orange juice crop. Yes, I did watch Trading Places. You know, these people who are preparing those reports have knowledge of the, you know, Florida orange juice crop, and that they actually know what they're talking about. And I'm just wondering, you know, when we're talking about these analysts and some of the guys you're naming, you know, are these people who are analysts or who are cannabis analysts? And, you know, that's where I'm kind of wondering, because it seems to me, and we've talked about how this market goes all over the place. You know, you talk about trading on news, and the example that I get tired of giving is when Sessions announced that they were going to table the Cole memorandum, and everybody panicked and wanted to sell and get out. And we said, why? You know, nothing has changed. You know, nothing here is new. And it just always concerned me that, you know, maybe some of the people who were calling the shots don't have the cannabis background and understanding to be able to really address these types of situations.
Sure. So, you know, you can quote Trading Places over there, Beaks. But what I'll tell you is I'd quote Vacation on this one and say, you know what I think? I think you're all fucked in the head, right? And I think that it's, you know, you look at these analysts, and they were not cannabis professionals. They certainly, you know, tried to understand the market, but the problem that they're facing off against is they didn't take the time to understand the underlying business, right? And so as you looked at some of these companies that were building out these massive growth facilities, and, you know, let's just use Canopy as an example, and I'm not trying to throw shade at, you know, Bruce Linton or anyone that, you know, predated the current team that's over there. But when they went out there and said, hey, we're going to build out, you know, a couple million square feet of cultivation, and, you know, for every square foot of cultivation, we expect to produce X amount of grams per square foot on an annualized basis, everyone goes, oh, wow, they're going to corner the market. They're going to, you know, produce this much. Okay, well, at the same time, the Green Organic Dutchman was doing that, and Aurora was doing that, and Afri was doing that, and Kronos was doing that, and they're all going out to their respective bankers and their respective capital sources and all the analysts, and saying we can produce this much, and that should translate into this much sales. Well, nobody took the time to say, is there a TAM that can actually absorb everything that's being produced? And if there's not, then it doesn't look sure. You could cultivate 10 million square feet of cannabis, but if there's only enough of a market to consume a million of that, then the rest of it's redundant. And that's where these guys got it completely and totally wrong for years, where they were looking at what the ability to produce was without actually looking at what the ability to consume was. And as it became increasingly apparent that everybody was building a brand new market, that the aggregate value of all this construction was a complete and total overbuild. You know, it's like if developers in New York City wanted to build 100 new high-rise office buildings, okay, that's great, but if you can't rent the space, then it's stupid. And that's the same idea here. And every time you thought that the walls were going to start caving in on these guys and that, you know, the cracks would emerge and it would start to hemorrhage, you had some other company like a Constellation Brands or an Altria come in and support these ridiculous valuations by making investments into companies like Canopy or Kronos. So every time the retail investor is like, okay, this is like, we're starting to agree these things are ridiculous, then you have this big company come in and completely validate, and everyone scratched their head going, you know, maybe we should give it another shot. Like, these guys are smart guys. Like, Constellation wouldn't put in $4.5 billion. They didn't know something we don't know. And then the fact of the matter is, they didn't, you know. And we watched it take down the U.S. market in 2019. And then we watched, you know, the U.S. market finally sort of emerge out of that going, like, look, don't, you know, throw the baby in with the bathwater, and look to us as much, you know, more stable company with a much bigger market. Granted, we can't cross state lines. We've got other, you know, issues we have to face off against. But ultimately, there's 330 million people in the U.S. versus, you know, the 30 million and change in Canada. This is a significantly better market. But you're still seeing the market cap of a Canopy be greater than the market cap of a GTI or a Cureleaf or a Trueleaf. So, you know, that's got to change. And I can tell you that here's the unfortunate part. Like, okay, the analysts are finally starting to get this thing right. But guess what? It's now going to cause the retail investors to second guess the U.S. market, because, again, they don't understand the differentiation between the Canadian market and the U.S. market. And so if these slashing of estimates is going to drive the price down of Canadian companies, very likely it's going to drag the U.S. companies down with them again, because people sell them the bad news. So it's, you know, it's the cycle that we've already seen repeating itself, that I think is terribly unfortunate to companies that are doing great work on this side of the border, because the Canadian guys got there first and the Canadian guys can actually list on the New York Stock Exchange and on the NASDAQ, where they're viewed to be, you know, quote, real companies as a result of the exchange they can list on. The only difference being that they've got, you know, a federal government under Trudeau that actually supports cannabis rather than a federal government under Biden that doesn't.
Well, that's a great point. And, you know, that can't be underestimated in terms of, you know, what may give Canadian companies the motivation to try to expand, you know, at the levels they're doing. When you have government support, you know, that's huge in this country. You know, other than the companies that have grown up within the industry itself, and, you know, like the Crescos and GTIs of the world. Last week, one of the other things we talked about was Scott's Turf Builder and their big, or Scott's at least, and their big foray into this market. And, you know, they're one of the really few, as far as I can tell, big traditional companies that made their name and their success in another field, you know, albeit grass, but they, you know, they want to stick their toe into this industry, and they're not being shy about it. And, you know, it's kind of interesting to see how that does play out and everything. But I, you know, I'm just always amazed that you know, people's willingness to start throwing values, whether it's on that level or, you know, even people applying for, you know, just a mom and pop cultivation license, and they're trying to go get a loan from somebody, and they have to start valuing their business. I'm like, on what basis are we valuing this business? But people have bought into this idea that if it's cannabis, it's got an outsized value, and it's, you know, that all you have to do is turn on the open sign and you start printing money. And as we all know, while there's plenty of examples of companies that have really cashed out big, you know, there's thousands of more that haven't.
Yeah, and look, the ancillary plays. I mean, Scotts Miracle-Gro is a prime example of it, and there's another huge deal announced recently where Signify, which is Philips Electronics, you know, it's their lighting side, just purchased Fluence, who was owned by Osram, which is a German company, and they bought that for $120 million, which is, you know, an absurd amount of money based on, you know, where they were in their life cycle. But a lot of that sheen has come off as well. If you look at, you know, the last like 6 months, Hawthorne's business and Scotts Miracle-Gro business, you know, has gone down significantly in value, and so has, you know, Hydrofarm has gone down by something like 60% since its highs. Grow Generation is getting absolutely decimated. They're, I think, 1/6 of what they were previously. So, you know, there's a lot of the ancillaries. And by the way, I was interviewed, I want to say about, you know, 10 months ago by U.S. News and World Report on ancillaries, and I was the only one of like four people, you know, including Tim Seymour from CNBC, that strongly advocated to sell off these businesses, where I said they're terribly overvalued. They might be good underlying businesses, but not at this price. And I'd like to, you know, sort of pat myself in the back that I got that one right for once and did it in print, where, you know, I can actually point to it later and say, look, you know, like I called this a long time ago. And not to be a bear on everything, because I'm a huge bull of the industry in general. But I'm very bearish when people assign valuations to businesses that they can't support. I mean, much like, you know, you guys talked about last week, but MJ Business's sale for, I think that was about $120 million as well, which represented 9.3 times, you know, standard EBITDA over the last 2 years. That's a lot of money for as a multiple for an events company or for a media company. And, you know, I know our producer, Dan Humiston, knows a fair amount about this. And, you know, Dan's reaction was that it's really not that out of whack for what people pay for these things. But, you know, like, cannabis companies aren't selling for 9.3 times EBITDA, even though they're trading at a higher multiple. They're not being purchased at a higher multiple. They're being purchased at, you know, 6 to 7 times EBITDA. And, you know, a lot of these companies aren't even truly EBITDA positive based on, you know, just how many other things they have to deal with. I mean, and even if they're EBITDA positive, they're certainly not net positive. Even if they're trading, you know, even if they're, you know, turning a 30, 40% EBITDA margin every year, they still might be net negative or net, you know, neutral, simply because of 280E, which happens after the EBITDA calculation. So it's, you know, fortunately the ancillaries don't have to deal with 280E, but, you know, just because you've got exposure to cannabis, whether you're IIPR or whether you're Hawthorne or whether you're, you know, Signify, you know, all these companies, they shouldn't get a value that's any greater than they would be for any other industry. It just doesn't make any sense to assign it, you know, something greater.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. You know, we have to be reasonable, and it doesn't do the industry any good for people to come in and assign values to it that can never be recognized or realized, because you start to turn people off on the benefits of the industry rather than giving them realistic views of what they can expect and where it might go. And, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, you know, the strides we've made. You know, we've talked about being at the 2013 MJ Biz show, and I just remember them sitting there showing us these charts of, you know, where we anticipate the market will be in 2020 and 2021. And the level of growth that they showed just seemed incomprehensible to me. And yet here we are. And, you know, and we've achieved a lot of that growth. But what's more amazing is I think that if you sat down and talked to people today, given the size still of the black market out there and the number of states that we still have that can still flip over and go to adult use and all of that, that the room for growth remains big. But, you know, you make a great point, and people have to remember this. You know, there's only so many people that like to smoke marijuana, and although there's a lot of them, it's not an unlimited supply. And at some point, we're going to have more marijuana than we need, which is a good problem, I guess.
That's why it makes it really interesting that companies like Tilray right now are saying, okay, we're not going to be a cannabis-only business. And we realize that, you know, we probably oversold our ability to sell cannabis. But we're sitting on a pile of cash in our balance sheet. We've got to put it somewhere. So where do we put it that actually allows us to realize the growth we promised to our shareholders? And what I find so fascinating about Tilray right now is they're doing the reverse of what everyone expected. Everyone thought the alcohol companies were going to come in and start buying the cannabis companies. And here's Tilray going out and buying alcohol companies. They bought, you know, Breckenridge Distillery. They bought Sweetwater, which is a massive, massive brewery in Atlanta, Georgia, who produces, you know, the 420 Pale Ale that Delta actually sells on every flight they put across the country. And now they've bought, you know, Green Flash and another brewery at the end of last year. So, you know, I would ask you, is Tilray a cannabis company now, or is it an alcohol company, or is it a true hybrid?
Well, that's a great question, but I have to tell you the irony of a marijuana company being big enough that it can go out and start buying alcohol companies is just delicious to me. I love that because, you know, the thought was that very quickly the alcohol companies are going to come in and they're going to, you know, they're always going to be in charge of the intoxicant markets and they'll buy out everything and they'll take over. Marijuana has grown so big so fast that, yes, a company like Tilray that is a marijuana company can now go in and we shouldn't lose sight, I think, of just how amazing that is to start. But to me, what I really like about this is if it becomes a trend, it's going to lead to normalization in the reverse way, right? Instead of traditional companies adopting cannabis and marijuana, we're going to have marijuana companies stepping in and expanding into traditional markets with other things based on the name that they've created for themselves in the marijuana market. I mean, right? That's part of the appeal there. So how wonderful is that, that a marijuana company says, we feel comfortable enough with our brand that we can stick our toe into alcohol or a different market and be doing our investors as good a service as if we were just doing maybe even better than if we were trying to do more cannabis investments right now.
Yeah, look, I mean, if I was a big enough cannabis company, I sure would be going out and trying to raise capital that is now relatively inexpensive for expansion and buying in businesses that might be more profitable than cannabis is in the near term. It makes a great deal of sense. If you've got access to capital the way the bigger guys do, then why not expand your footprint into new verticals? So I don't think it's a bad plan that these guys are moving forward with.
No, I don't think it's, I mean, you know, I can't speak to it, you know, on the same level, you know, from a business perspective, but certainly on an industry-wide perspective, I think it's wonderful to see. You know, it gets interesting because a big part of the marijuana speech always, of course, is that we're the healthier alternative to alcohol for intoxication and all of that. You know, and once you start to combine the two together, you lose that a little bit, but I don't see that as much of a problem. And again, I love the idea that maybe at the end of the day, it will be the marijuana companies that really do dominate, you know, the market for alcohol and marijuana and who knows what else, you know, anything that falls under the intoxicant label that the government says, you know, can now legally be sold. And, you know, that might be, we might find that to be a lot better for those industries ultimately to have a strong marijuana presence at the top of the food chain than to have a strong alcohol presence at the top of the marijuana chain.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, kind of going back a couple minutes and again sort of shifting into our next topic is accurately putting a price on an asset is critically important, not just from the standpoint of, you know, selling it, but from the standpoint of being able to attract new capital. And what I'll say is that, you know, as a lot of these companies, the ones you've talked about that have flamed out, that have not been successful, oftentimes it's because they went out with so much hubris in the beginning and said, oh, our company should be worth $100 million, and they raised capital at a valuation that was unsustainable, that when they tried to go out for a second round of capital, there's no way they could do it without going through a down round because they had never proved out that the value they tried to initially go with was sustainable. So I think the companies I've watched to be really successful, including some of the largest companies we talked about, whether it's like the GTIs or the Curaleafs, they're relatively modest when they first came out of the gate and put a value on their business. And the people that got in early did very well. And every round they've had subsequently has gone up. So I think it's important for entrepreneurs, that are listening out there, when you actually think about what your business is worth when you go out for your Series A or even for your friends and family round, to not be overly aggressive, because you want to give room to scale your business and to look attractive to the next round of investor. And I think a group that's done that relatively well is our producer Dan Humiston's daughter Carson Humiston with her company Vangst, who has now been successful at attracting a true Series B from out of industry participants that it represents a meaningful investment. It was, I think the top line was a $19 million investment, Larry, is that right?
That's right. It's just, look, it's wonderful to see for a lot of reasons. From my experience or from my personal perspective, I'll just toot my own horn just long enough to say that I met Carson back when Dan was first getting the International Cannabis Association up and running, which subsequently became the Cannabis World Congress. And even then, as a college student who came to Las Vegas to help with all the organization, she seemed like an incredibly talented person. To sit there and tell you that I was bright enough to see that she might do something like this, I would be lying, but it certainly doesn't surprise me. Although I know Carson is someone who sometimes tends to avoid the spotlight, I don't want the moment to pass without both, certainly congratulating her and, of course, our producer Dan Humiston, who is her father and should be a proud father in this situation, like any of us would be if our children could be that successful, and especially that successful in the cannabis industry. But, she was the right person in the right place at the right time. But even more than that, I think, really possesses the social skills in terms of how do you go out and how do you really speak up your business and how do you get potential investors to buy into what you see as your dream. And, look, it's not that hard of a sell, I don't think, to get people to see that as this industry grows, there is an ever-increasing demand, not just for labor, but for skilled labor. And, I think more and more it's going to become important that, gone are the days of, a hottie or, a dude-looking type of bud tender who would just give you, hey, man, you catch the panic show last night? Yeah, what? We're moving into an era now where people expect a certain level of professionalism. And if they want to ask their bud tender a question, that the bud tender can actually answer it, and be able to give them something back that makes sense to them. And, those people are out there, but like any other industry, what business owner has the time to go out and find all these people? And Carson's done an amazing job of, finding both the businesses and finding the people and putting them together. And I think it's wonderful to see, couldn't be happier for her. And, I'm sure that the people who invested with her will find themselves very happy in the long run. Certainly hope so.
Yeah. And for our listeners out there that aren't familiar with what Carson does and what Vangst does, which is V-A-N-G-S-T, it's a recruiting platform. So if you've got staffing needs in your cannabis business, I'll give a pretty heavy shout out to Carson and her team. If you're looking for employees, if you're looking for hires, definitely turn to Vangst. Now, having said that, Carson, when you listen to the show, I certainly expect you'll start advertising with us now with your newfound $19 million. So, this is first one's free, kid. First one's free. But after this, I am very supportive of, people that are looking to get involved in the cannabis industry and looking for a place where they can actually put their CV or resume. Vangst is a great place to do it, and it's a great place for employers to seek out talent and qualified people. So, again, congrats to Carson, congrats to the entire Vangst team.
And I'll tell you, one of the things I like about Vangst as well is, my impression of these types of things is always, look, we need bud tenders, we need people to work in cultivation centers, we're looking for young college graduates, people who have an interest in the industry. But there's a lot of guys, and I've got a couple of buddies, who have been, who are been in the industry, as it were, for years and years and years, and one or two of them who wound up on the wrong side of the law and did a little time at courtesy of the state guest house, and they're now looking, many of these people are now looking for a way to come back into the industry, and Vangst is there to provide a platform for a lot of people. And I think that certainly that older generation of folks who were providing cannabis for all of us back before we had the Crescos and GTIs of the world, still have a lot that they can impart on today's market. And, it's always great to see the support for that as well. The people who help push things finally have a chance to get a piece of the pie. So shout out to that part of it as well. And, in fact, I don't even know of any other placement agency in the cannabis industry. So if anybody asked me who I would recommend, I would tell them Vangst and definitely tell them to move in that direction. So, yes, certainly shout outs and congratulations to all. And also congratulations to Dan as a father. I can certainly understand the paternal pride there. And, even if our kids don't want us to acknowledge it, sometimes we just have to. Well, that's a lot for today. We've got a lot to talk about. We have a lot more good stuff coming up as we go forward, and we start to look at what the possibilities are for possibly summer tours and whether Dead and Company can figure out a way to rebound it. And one other thing I just want to throw in there in the midst of all of this, in my opinion, at least from what I can tell, didn't really get enough conversation, is that now when they're talking about Billy Kreutzmann, it's no longer a non-COVID respiratory issue. Now they're talking about it being a heart issue. And again, I have no idea what that means, and I haven't heard anything that suggests an imminent problem one way or the other than to recognize that these guys are all in their, mid to late 70s now. And Phil, of course, we know is in his 80s. And, that's, to me, is ultimately the worst part about having to cancel playing in the sand is, how much longer do these guys really have to be able to, and admittedly, Phil wasn't going to be there for this go-around. But, even for any of them, they're all old. Even the perpetual teenager, Bob Weir, is now an old man. And, it's hard to see, your childhood heroes get to that stage, but it's great to see that they're still, kicking it on and trying to get it all done. But whatever is going on with Bill Kreutzmann, certainly our best wishes to him and hope that he will be able to rejoin the band and, bring back his, very large and always present personality in everything that they do.
Yeah, well said. Well said, Larry. So I figured I'd leave us at the end of this episode with, because it was kind of an end of an era. There's very few duets that were done, with the Godshaws, but Passenger being kind of a prime example of one. And anyone that's a Passenger fan, I think it's mostly a Passenger fan because the Lightning Garcia licks that come at the end of that song. So as I sign off and say thanks, we'll see you next week. I'll leave you with knowing that the Passenger outro is what we'll sign off this show with. But from Linnea Holdings, this is Rob Hunt, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you, Rob. As always, Larry Michigan from Michigan Law. Thanks for joining us, and enjoy your cannabis responsibly.